Good evening, and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio in the Lehigh Valley. I'm John Pierce, along with Ray Schwab. Ray, you doing well this evening?
Oh, thank you. I'm good.
You're
How are you?
Looking very good.
You as well.
We are ready for a very interesting hour talking about religion. Our topic is Christian and Jewish dialogues. And our guest is Dr. Franklin Sherman, who has written a book called Bridges, Documents of the Christian-Jewish Dialogue. Let's tell you a little bit about Dr. Sherman. He is the founding director of the Institute for Jewish and Christian Understanding at Muhlenberg College here in Allentown. He began his teaching career at the School of Religion at the University of Iowa, teaching subsequently at Mansfield College, Oxford, England, and for 23 years at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. So, Frank, you had a pretty good dipping your toe into the Midwest.
Oh, yes. I was an adopted Midwesterner.
And even sneaked off to England for a while.
Right.
He was at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, where he served for 10 years as dean. He's been a visiting lecturer at the University of Chicago and Northwestern University. Ray, do you know where Northwestern University is?
That's out in Chicago, right?
It is just north of Chicago in that wonderful town called Evanston.
Right.
Yes. That's my hometown.
Really? I did not. I learn something new about you every night, John.
There you go. Some of it's good. And then Dr. Sherman served at academic institutions in Israel, Switzerland, Zimbabwe, and Japan. He was brought up in Allentown, graduated from William Allen High School, which in those days, Frank, was called what?
Allentown High School, the only one in town.
You go away, but there was no Dereff.
No Dereff.
Oh, he goes back that far, right? His undergraduate degree is from Muhlenberg College and his doctorate from the University of Chicago. Dr. Sherman is an ordained minister of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, has served for many years as chair of its consultative panel on Lutheran-Jewish relations. He also served as managing editor of the international interfaith website, jcreations.net.
JC Relations.
jcrelations.net.
Jewish Christian.
Right. And Dr. Sherman is also the author of The Promise of Heschel, a study of the Jewish scholar Abraham Joshua Heschel, as well as in numerous essays and reviews in the field of Christian-Jewish relations. He edited and provided historical introductions and annotations for Luther's writings on the Jews and Judaism, as found in Volume 47 of the 55-volume Luther's Works, American Edition. His current project is preparing a two-volume collection of the most significant statements on Christian-Jewish relations issued by Christian, Jewish, and interfaith bodies around the world since World War II. The first volume was published by Paulist Press in 2011, which John had referenced earlier. And it's entitled Bridges, Documents of the Christian-Jewish Dialogue, Volume 1, The Road to Reconciliation, 1945 to 1965, and Volume 2, you're working on... Oh, 85, I'm sorry. And 1945, that was just after World War II had ended, and that's when it was that early that had begun?
Had begun, in the sense of the first traces, the first elements of the whole thing, yes.
And what exactly constituted that? What were the actions?
Let's see. We could start with something called the Stuttgart Declaration of Guilt. Right after the war, this was in August of 1945. The war had ended only a few months earlier in Europe, and it was to end that very month in Japan, in the Pacific. And the leaders of the church in Germany, some of whom had been active opponents of the Nazis, but not all, gathered in Stuttgart, which was in ruins, of course. And there, a delegation visited them from the World Council of Churches, headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland, which itself was only still in process of formation. It was supposed to have been formed in 1939. The war broke out. So in any case, it was enough of an energy to send these delegates to Stuttgart. And the German leaders prepared a declaration that they wanted to present to these representatives of world Christianity. Now, by that I mean Protestant and Eastern Orthodox. The Roman Catholic is something else, and we'll come to that shortly.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to go into that now or a couple of other things and then come to that.
Well, we would like the listeners to know also first right off the bat that if you do have any questions through the program for Dr. Sherman, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. Again, that's 610-758-8810.
We'd like to hear from you if you have a question or a comment to make. So, Frank, was anybody else involved in the project of assembling and publishing the documents that you have put into this book called Bridges?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what the book is, basically. It's not a book you're going to open up and read from one to page 1 to page 425 or whatever it is. It is a collection of documents. In that sense, it's a reference work. And if you were taking a class in a college or university on it, the professor would probably say, well, read documents 7, 11, 42, and et cetera, and we'll talk about it.
Skip around a little bit.
These are statements that were made by Christian bodies, starting with that one, which we'll come back to, I believe, in Stuttgart, about the whole question of Christianity's relation to Judaism. Over the years, the negative image of Jews and Judaism that unfortunately had been promulgated to no small extent by Christian teaching and preaching, and now that the Holocaust had happened, everybody stood back in shock and said, first of all, our utmost sympathy and so on to the victims and to the survivors. But were we in any way responsible, we as Christians? Well, not we as Christians sitting in Cincinnati or someplace like that, but we in a collective sense as the church, have our teachings contributed anything to that? So there were many statements from then all the way down to the most recent that I know of is September of 2012. But we put these together, and I did have helpers on it. And appropriately enough, it was one Protestant, one Catholic, and one Jew. Okay, the Protestant is Professor Alice Eckhart of Lehigh University, retired now, Professor Emerita, who, with her late husband Roy Eckhart, has written about and dealt with these things for decades. And then the Catholic collaborator was Professor Philip Cunningham of St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, where he runs an institute very similar to our Institute for Jewish Christian Understanding here at Muhlenberg College. And the Jewish collaborator, Professor Michael Kogan of Montclair State University, professor of Jewish studies there, who weighed in, each of them, with a survey from the Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish points of view.
And at the beginning of the book, we have statements by these three collaborators.
Yes.
From the three points of view.
Yes.
On the whole issue of Christian-Jewish dialogue.
Those three introductions plus the preface by myself are worth the price of admission.
Now, you mentioned that there was contributions from, the Jewish who were represented, Protestant and Catholic. Were there any Muslims involved?
Not at that early stage. Now, if we were dealing with the time now or the last 10 years, it would be the case that tri-faith dialogue, not in the old sense of Protestant, Catholic, Jew, but in the new sense of Christian, Jewish, Muslim, would be what we would talk about. But it was not a factor in those early years from 45 down to 85.
And we are talking in this book, Ray, the years are this 40-year span, 1945, 1985, and that is Volume 1. So we're assuming that there's going to be a Volume 2.
There is. Might be out in another year or two.
All right. So you're working hard on that right now?
Day and night.
He took time off to come in for our interview, Ray.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that.
Absolutely. And the The Second World War had just ended in 45, we said. Did the road to reconciliation really start that early?
Well, it did, as I mentioned a moment ago, with this declaration in Stuttgart. May I say a little more about that?
Sure.
I described the scene. Here are these German representatives sitting in the ruined city of Stuttgart and receiving these people from comfortable Switzerland and over from America, but also from bombed-out Britain and other parts of the world. And they made a statement. They said, I'll just quote from it. They said, "With great anguish, we," that means we German representatives, "we state, through us has endless suffering been brought to many peoples and their countries."
Are these Protestants and Roman Catholics?
No, they're just Protestants in this case. But it's striking that they didn't say through the Nazis or through our leaders. They said through us. They realized that simply as Germans, they had to take responsibility. And they said, "We have struggled for many years in the name of Jesus Christ against the National Socialist regime." Now, as I said earlier, some had, others hadn't. But what they say here is, we have struggled, but we accuse ourselves for not witnessing more courageously, for not praying more faithfully, for not believing more joyously, and for not loving more ardently. And that's an eloquent statement.
Yes, it is. That's just exactly what I was thinking, too.
And then they state, well, we want to make a new beginning. We want to cleanse ourselves from any form of anti-Semitism and begin our work again amongst our people.
So that's the very beginning of these documents on Christian and Jewish dialogue.
Yes. May I mention what would be the next one? We can't keep going with all of these through the whole. There are, I think, 68 documents in the book as a whole. But one of the other early ones was a statement by the World Council of Churches, which had gone to visit the Germans. But now, about 6 months later, but that's still very soon after the war, February 1946, the World Council makes a statement. And it says, "We wish to record our deep sense of horror at the unprecedented tragedy which has befallen the Jewish people in consequence of the Nazi attempt to exterminate European Jewry." Now, in a sense, it took a while for it to sink in, certainly over here in America, what the extent and depth of this, what we would now call genocidal attack upon the Jews, was. The word Holocaust had not been invented at that time, or applied, let's say, nor the other term, Shoah, but they speak of it in these words, the Nazi attempt to exterminate, that means to wipe out, European Jewry. And that almost succeeded, sad to say. But the World Council then says, "We are thankful for those Christians who witnessed against, protested against, struggled against that regime. We also acknowledge the failure of the churches to not do so sufficiently," as they had already said in their eloquent words on confession. And they call upon Christians everywhere to testify against the principles and practices of anti-Semitism, and so on. And then they go on to urge certain practical consequences. In that time, just 6 months after the end of the war, efforts to find acceptable homes for Jews who have been displaced or who could no longer remain where they are. You can picture the tumult still at that time. So that was significant for who said it, the World Council of Churches, and for the fact that it was that early.
Now, you mentioned the Holocaust, which, of course, everybody has heard of, but not everybody, I think, has heard of the word Shoah before. What's the difference there, Frank?
Well, they're used to refer to the same situation or the same sequence of events. Although sometimes we speak about the Shoah, the Holocaust in Cambodia or whatever, some people would prefer to keep it just for this, what happened to the Jews under the Nazis. But the Holocaust is a term from Greek, and it's used to refer to what in the Old Testament is called a whole burnt offering. You present an offering to the Lord. So the use of that term implied that these 6 million victims were somehow an offering to the Lord, which puts a kind of a religious cast or even defense upon it. And there was later on a realization of that fact and a desire to find a different term which wouldn't in any way imply there was anything positive about what happened. The word Shoah is from the Hebrew, and it means catastrophe or calamity. And that is the word that is preferred by many today, although, of course, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, as an example, has not changed its name. So we'll have both terms with us for a long time, I believe.
All right. That's good to know that term.
Do you think that there's going to be a strong movement in the near future to begin using that word Shoah in replacement?
Well, in Jewish sources, it's used very broadly, and in Christian sources that are sensitive to this problem that I mentioned about the word Holocaust, and also simply out of deference to the Jewish dialogue partners who do prefer that term. So it's increasingly used, yes.
I don't think a lot of people realize that religious sentiment in that word, Holocaust, to even know that it has that meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fortunate in a sense, because then it doesn't convey this wrong sense.
That almost positive aspect of it.
That's right.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, and we are chatting with Dr. Franklin Sherman, editor of the book Bridges, Documents of the Christian-Jewish Dialogue. If you would like to be in dialogue with us, you can give us a call at
610-758-8810. Again, that's 610-758-8810 if you have any questions for Dr. Sherman.
Frank, I see in the book there's something called the 10 Points of Seelisberg.
That's right.
Tell us about that. Shall we take our break first?
We might want to save that for after the break. We're going to be taking a quick break on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Stay tuned. We're with Dr. Franklin Sherman and, of course, John Pierce discussing Christian and Jewish relations. Stay there.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio.
Back with Lehigh Valley Discourse, speaking with Dr. Franklin Sherman this evening about Christian-Jewish dialogue. We have mentioned the different documents that are in this book of yours, which is over 400 pages, Frank. Where do the statements come from?
Well, you know, they really come from all over the world, and it's interesting that you ask that because, of course, there are statements from the U.S., almost all the major Protestant denominations, all of them, I would say, have made statements on this question over the years, the Roman Catholic Church repeatedly. But we also have statements from Europe, from England. I made a little list here. England, Scotland, Germany, and the different regional churches in Germany that's kind of broken up into different areas. We have statements from France, Italy, Switzerland, Norway, Holland, Hungary, Brazil. And then, of course, from the international entities, namely the Vatican, the whole Roman Catholic Church per se, and as we were speaking of the World Council of Churches, which is Protestant and Eastern Orthodox.
The great majority of the statements are from Europe.
Well, yes, there's more countries there.
Right. And you have one, I think, that you mentioned from Latin America. Was that Brazil?
Brazil. That's right. Of course, in Latin America, many Europeans have settled, as you know, and so they take the memory and the conscience about this with them.
Right. We mentioned the term Seligsberg before, and there's something called the 10 points of Seligsberg. What is that about, Frank?
Well, I'll tell you, Seligsberg is a small village in Switzerland.
Let's spell it.
Oh, my. S-E-E-L-I-S-B-E-R-G. I guess it means town by the sea. Seligsberg. Maybe it doesn't. A listener can call in and correct that, perhaps. In any case, a meeting was held there in 1947, which was called the Emergency International Conference to Combat Anti-Semitism, and was called by the National Council of the Churches, or the National Conference of Christians and Jews here in the United States, which incidentally was established way back in 1922. So in that sense, this Christian-Jewish dialogue has been going on longer than we might think. The NCCJ, as people
know it. Going on 100 years.
Just about.
90 years.
Yes. Now, it wasn't very theological in those early days. It was more addressing common problems in society. But in any case, the National Conference of Christians and Jews in the United States and the corresponding body in Britain called together others involved in this whole matter from elsewhere, mostly from Europe, and they met at this little town. And they issued various statements, but the one that became famous was called the 10 Points of Seligsberg.
Let's save that the more specifics about that because we have a caller on the line. Would you give us your first name and where you're calling from, please?
Yeah, my name's Tony, calling from Allentown.
Tony, thanks so much for calling in. What would you like to say?
Well, what I'd like to know and I'm interested about is in the Third Reich, during the war years, was there any attempt to give theological justification to the annihilation of Jews and Gypsies during that time?
On the part of the churches?
On the part of, no, actually on the part of the Third Reich, on the part of the government itself.
Well, it's, I also thought you might be asking about the churches, and unfortunately there was an element of trying to give theological justification for that, and then there was the protest against that by people like Martin Niemöller, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and so on. On the part of the government, their viewpoints, and I'm not a specialist on this period, but I would say were expressed primarily in racial terms or in terms of the folk, the people. And they viewed the Jews as weakening and, I have to say, poisoning the purity of the German folk and yeah. Aryans in general. They didn't tend to invoke Christian categories, I think, in their propaganda as a whole.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you very much for fielding my call.
Okay.
And if any other listeners have questions, you could give us a call at 610-758-8810. Again, that's 610-758-8810. We'd like to hear from you.
So, Frank, back to Seligsberg.
All right.
And these 10 points.
Well, the introductory part says, among other things, it's and by the way, this was Christians and Jews in this meeting, but this particular statement is called an address to the churches, and it was by Christians in the meeting to their fellow Christians around the world. They said, "It is shocking to discover that 2,000 years of preaching of the gospel of love have not sufficed to prevent the manifestation among Christians in various forms of hatred and distrust towards Jews. We therefore address ourselves to the churches to draw their attention to this alarming situation." And among the 10 points, some of them are this.
Now, again, the group of people or groups who made the statement were?
They were representing the National Conference of Christians and Jews in the States, what's called the Council of Christians and Jews in Britain, and similar-minded people from other European countries. So they said, remember that one God speaks to us all through the Old and the New Testaments. Well, you might say that's obvious. But down through history, there have been attempts to set the one over against the other. You know, the God of judgment and vengeance in the Old Testament versus the God of love and mercy in the New Testament was not the case because the God of the Old Testament is both judging and merciful. The God of the New Testament is both merciful and judging. So they said, remember that. It's the same God. Secondly, remember that Jesus was born of a Jewish mother, of the seed of David and the people of Israel, and that the first disciples, the apostles, and the first martyrs were all Jews. Again, that's self-evident when you think about it. But there's sometimes a tendency to look at it, we Christians, they Jews, but all of these first Christians, as it were Jews. And then, I won't read all the points, but one of them is this: avoid distorting or misrepresenting biblical or post-biblical Judaism with the object of extolling Christianity. In other words, you find the bad things in Judaism and compare them with the good things in Christianity. Take our best and compare to your worst. Well, of course, both faiths have their noble side, and both have a certain underside. If you look very carefully, that is of enmity towards others. But both faiths in our day, of course, have made efforts to uproot that, eliminate it from liturgies, and so on. Then this point is made: avoid presenting the passion, that means the crucifixion and death of Jesus, in such a way as to bring the odium of the killing of Jesus upon all Jews or upon Jews alone. It was only a section, they say, a section of the Jews in Jerusalem who demanded the death of Jesus. And the Christian message has always been that it was the sins in which all people share that brought Christ to the cross. If we had been there, Christians often are told by their preachers, we would have. If you've been there, you would have done the same thing.
Exactly.
And it says, avoid referring to the cry of a raging mob, his blood be upon us and our children, not of the vast majority of the people, of a few hundred people gathered into the courtyard at that particular time before Pilate. Avoid referring to the cry of a raging mob without remembering that this cry should not count against the infinitely more weighty words of our Lord, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You can see that these people were passionate about these statements. To us, they're words on the page, but they were spoken right out into the midst of history and of the situation in which they were living.
So, the 10 points of Seligsberg. Again, we've learned something here, Ray. We're not going to be able to cover all the statements in the book that you have edited here, Frank, which is called Bridges, Documents of the Christian-Jewish Dialogue, and the date on it is 2011, so it is pretty new.
Now, if any of the listeners were interested in finding a copy of this book, would they be able to find it on the web?
On Amazon.com.
Amazon.com?
Sure. Mm-hmm. And there are other books on bridges that have to do with the Triborough Bridge in New York and other bridges around the world. So be sure to use the subtitle, Bridges, Documents of the Christian-Jewish Dialogue, or search under my name, Franklin Sherman.
It sounds as if you've had that experience, Frank.
Indeed.
On the web. It can be daunting. In fact, one of the interesting problems that somebody brought up about searches on the web was, how do you search for Martin Luther and Martin Luther King, and how do you distinguish between the two and make sure that you're going only for those of whichever one you're
right
after?
It almost seems like when you type it into Google, Martin Luther, it's going to finish it for you. Martin Luther King.
Right. How about the Second Vatican Council, the 1960s? That was a very important point.
Well, it was.
History.
And that enables us, your question there, to turn to the Roman Catholic side of this thing. It's often thought, I must say, that the whole Christian-Jewish reconciliation or rapprochement began with the Second Vatican Council. But that's not the case, because we've already covered the period from 1945 on, in which there were these various statements, mostly from Protestant groups. But nobody wants bragging rights. That's just to put the historical record straight. But certainly, you know, if you had to pick one event in this whole period from 1945 till now that stands out as a gleaming point and focus of this whole question, it would be the Second Vatican Council. Now, what is a council? A council of the Roman Catholic Church is a gathering of all the bishops of the world. So there's not just hundreds, but thousands of them there. As many as 3,000 bishops took place, not necessarily all at one time, certainly at least 2,000 at a time. And the thing lasted for 4 years, as I recall, four sessions over a 3 to 4 year period. They gathered there in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. There are pictures of them lined up, and what are pews for people to be there to worship? They're all filled with bishops. And they deliberated in a democratic way, deciding things by majority vote. One thing that's not generally appreciated is that such a council is the top authority in Roman Catholicism, superior even to the Pope.
That I didn't know.
At its highest level, the Roman Catholic Church is a constitutional democracy. And these pronouncements, therefore, have great weight. And by the way, such a council, it's met on the average only once every 100 years since the founding of Christianity. So it's pretty rare and therefore very, very momentous. And among many other groundbreaking statements, such as definitively accepting the church and state and religious pluralism as part of the modern world, among many other such statements, they made one on Christian-Jewish relations, which is called Nostra Aetate. These statements from the Vatican are named by the first two words in Latin. So Nostra Aetate means in our time. And the statement depicts the fact that in our time we are experiencing interreligious encounter ever more and more. And another part of this statement, by the way, deals with Catholic-Muslim relations. But right now we're on this Christian-Jewish subject.
Right. And the council that you're speaking of, Vatican II, it was almost 50 years ago now.
It was. It was, in fact, it convened in 1962. So it was 50 years ago. Right. And the pronouncement that we are talking about on the Jews was issued in 1965. These bishops didn't spend the whole time there. They spent months, took a break, went home and did their day job, so to speak, then came back for another several months, etc., over that whole period of time. But in this statement, Nostra Aetate, it starts this way: as this sacred synod searches into the mystery of the church, it remembers the bond that spiritually ties the people of the new covenant to Abraham's stock. In other words, Christian self-examination, theologically and spiritually, leads to our Jewish roots. I say our, being one of them myself, leads to our Jewish roots. So in that sense, it's an internal matter as well as a relationship to the other out there. It was an earlier pope who said, spiritually, we are all Semites. And that is certainly the sense of this document as well. So it goes on, thus the Church of Christ acknowledges that, according to God's saving design, the beginnings of her faith and her election are found already among the patriarchs, Moses, and the prophets. But then they jump down, I'll jump down anyway, to the New Testament time, and they say, the statement says, as Holy Scripture testifies, Jerusalem did not recognize the time of her visitation. That means, a prophet would come and people would not listen. That's what it means. And it's applying that category to Jesus and his reception. Nor did Jews in large number accept the gospel. That's true historically. Nevertheless, God holds the Jews, they say, most dear for the sake of their fathers. He does not repent of the gifts that he makes or of the calls that he issues. And the word is, it is saying the covenant with Jews that began with the Jews, which began with Abraham, continues with Moses, David, and so on, has never been revoked. It continues on down to the present time. This had not been said so clearly before.
And so Vatican II helped to bring this to the fore.
That's right. Let me just add there.
And let me remind our listeners, now that you're speaking, that this is Dr. Franklin Sherman, who is a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church.
That's
so
true.
So when you say, I or we as a group, you're talking about Christians and more specifically Lutherans.
Yes. Well, mostly what I've said up to now is speaking for all Christians, which is pretty bold, but these documents come from all quarters.
Right.
But just let me give you the last sentence here of this Nostra Aetate. It says, the Church, mindful of the patrimony she shares with the Jews, decries hatred, persecutions, displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews at any time and by anyone. So that puts Christians, in this case Catholics, but Protestants have appreciated this particular statement too a lot, on notice that anti-Semitism is a contradiction to the gospel of Jesus Christ, which they are devoted to preaching.
In a way, you could say anti-Semitism is anti-Jesus Christ.
Yes, that's what they do want to say.
As I understand, he was a Jew.
Correct.
I did get that one right, Ray. So if we have listeners who would like to join our conversation, our phone number, Ray?
That phone number is 610-758-8810. Again, if you have any questions for Dr. Sherman on Christian and Jewish relations or any of the topics we've covered tonight, that number is 610-758-8810.
Frank, you have put together quite a weighty tome here, over 400 pages of statements made by different religious groups, and it goes from 1945 to 1985. This is volume one, and so right now you're talking about working on volume two. So go ahead. What would you like to say?
Well, the thing is, I just wanted to slip this in before we get to volume two. Namely, that, as you said earlier, I'm a Lutheran myself. Now, who are the Lutherans? Listen to Garrison Keillor, you get a very funny sense of what Lutheranism is, and we don't mind that at all. We adopt him. But the Lutheran Church, as you know, emerged from the Reformation period, the work of Martin Luther, and it has some 60 million members around the world. It's one of the more substantial Christian bodies. Okay, so it is in the heritage of Martin Luther. That's a good thing, and in the sense of tonight's topic, not such a good thing. The preaching of the gospel and all of that came forward with Martin Luther, the recovery of the doctrine of justification by faith, etc., etc. We could go into that theologically. But it happens that Luther, in the latter part of his life, made some very, very serious and, I would say, scurrilous statements about Jews. In fact, he wrote a whole book about the subject called On the Jews and Their Lies. How's that for a title?
Von den Juden
und ihre Lügen. Yes,
L-I-E-S.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And now this is not generally known by most Lutherans even. Most Lutheran clergy, up until recently, were not really aware of this because there it is in the huge edition of Luther's works in German or even in English. And why would you want to turn to that? But back in the 1990s, the early 1990s, there were a number of things that brought public attention to this in the here in the United States. For example, Alan Dershowitz, well-known spokesman, professor of law at Harvard University and Jewish by self-identification, wrote an autobiography called, interestingly enough, Chutzpah. And in this autobiography, he ran through how, as a young person, he first learned about this this anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic feeling out there in the world. And he gradually learned that this was connected up with Christian teaching in some way and that Luther was one of the worst anti-Semites. And he said, I don't know how anybody could even use the word Lutheran today as a description of their denomination in the light of this. And there were other things like that that brought it to public attention. So let me mention one thing, though. In the United States, in Washington, the Holocaust Memorial Museum opened in early 1994, if I'm not mistaken. And there... It may have been earlier than that. It may have been the preceding year. In any case, there as you work your way through the exhibits, you come to a place where you can go into a little theater and watch a film on anti-Semitism. And featured in that in a very major way is Martin Luther. And as his anti-Jewish writings are quoted from pictures of the demonic representations of Jews in that late medieval period are put up on the screen, and you come away knowing doggone well that there was something wrong with this hero of the faith. There was a dark side, just as there may be to most of us.
We are chatting on Lehigh Valley Discourse with Dr. Franklin Sherman, and we will be back after this break, back in 60 seconds.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater on Bethlehem's South Side, presenting Going Green the Wong Way. Created and performed by Christina Wong, this true life adventure takes us from Christina's confrontational sixth grade science project to her wandering years as a missionary of recycling to her true calling as Los Angeles's patron martyr of carbon-free living. November 16th and 17th. For tickets and information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
Dr. Franklin Sherman is with us here, Ray Schwab, along with John Pierce on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we have a caller on the line. Would you please tell us your first name and where you're calling from?
This is Mark in Washington, D.C.
Mark from Washington, D.C. You must be listening on WDIY.org.
I am.
Excellent. What would you like to say, Mark?
Well, I was wondering, for those of us who were born after World War II and for whom some of this could seem like ancient history, whether you'd like to comment on the extent to which anti-Semitism is alive and well. And, for example, what would happen if either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party were to nominate a Jewish man or woman for president? What would be the reaction today?
Well, thanks, Mark, for your call, and that's a good question. Anti-Semitism does still exist. In fact, particularly in Europe, there have been serious outbursts. I mean, right down to the present moment in France, Germany, Hungary. And but fortunately not here in the United States. By that I don't mean that there are not anti-Semitic attitudes in part, but there have been no shootings, no whatever of that nature. However, on your question about the president, we had a dry run on that, didn't we, when Joseph Lieberman was nominated to be vice president, because somebody is, if you're going to vote for him for vice president, you are realizing that he could, in an instant, become president. And the striking thing is that there was no outcry against that. Even the usual, if I may say so, far right-wing anti-Semites didn't find it possible to make a big play out of that.
And in fact, they later accepted him into their party as well.
Yes, that's right. And the striking thing about Senator Lieberman is that he was and is an observant Orthodox Jew. If he has to come in for a vote on a Saturday, he walks there and walks home again and so on. So I believe that's a testimony to the fact that we have come a ways in American society.
We also had the example of Barry Goldwater before Lieberman.
Very good point.
And who was a presidential candidate who wound up not winning.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason was that he was too much of a saber rattler for most people. I don't think it was his Jewishness.
No, I lived through that, as did you, and I don't remember that being a motif at all.
Mark, does that answer your question?
I actually believe Mark is off the line.
Mark's off the line. Okay. We appreciate his call. All the way from Washington, D.C. So, Frank, back to our topic.
Okay. I think we were dealing with the Lutheran statement, and let me just quote a little from it. It says, "The Lutheran communion of faith is linked by name and heritage to the memory of Martin Luther, teacher and reformer. Honoring his name in our own Okay, we can get away from that. We recall his bold stand for truth, his earthy and sublime words of wisdom, and above all, his witness to God's saving word. Luther, it says, proclaimed a gospel for people as we really are, bidding us to trust a grace sufficient to reach our deepest shames and address the most tragic truths. Now, that's been applied to individuals. Okay, you have to sincerely confess your sin and then receive the proclamation of forgiveness. But here it's applied to the church itself, to our denomination. The statement goes on. In the spirit of that truth-telling, we who bear his name and heritage must, with pain, acknowledge also Luther's anti-Judaic diatribes and the violent recommendations of his later writings against the Jews. We reject this violent invective, and yet more do we express our deep and abiding sorrow over its tragic effects on subsequent generations. We particularly deplore the appropriation of Luther's words by modern anti-Semites for the teaching of hatred towards Judaism or toward the Jewish people in our day. And it goes on to pledge that we will strive to live out our lives as Christians with, quote, love and respect for the Jewish people. Let me add, John and Ray, that at the Holocaust Museum, after this came out, and without any request from us on the side of the Lutheran Church, the museum added a postscript to that film I was telling you about, saying that these sentiments have been rejected and repudiated by modern Christians, including the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which in April 1994 adopted a statement saying, and then quoting from this statement that I just read. So it's up there, or it has been up there, so far as I know it still is, as saying at least that we have not left these things unexamined or unrepudiated.
Right, and what you're bringing forth here in the attitude of Martin Luther toward Jews is a striking example of what you have called, Frank, the underside of religion, where we want to think that it's positive and that love is at the center of everything. And then when we come up against statements that obviously are not promoting love, it sometimes makes people who are not churched think, why would I want to join? Why would I want to...
Right.
To be a member of a congregation if that's the attitude. And so I think we always have to be aware that individuals say things, and we've seen it on the campaign circuit now. An individual will say something, and then that blows up in the press, and everybody wants to know, why did that person say that? And so the same thing with some religious pronouncements as well.
As we sometimes say, we don't see the church as a sanctuary of saints, but as a hospital for sinners.
Well said. Frank, the organization of the book called Bridges, Documents of the Christian-Jewish Dialogue, which was published last year, tell us a little bit about the organization, how you put it together.
Well, first we have the Protestant statements in chronological order, starting with that Stuttgart Declaration of Guilt just a few months after the end of the Second World War and coming down to the end of this period that we're dealing with, to 1985. And then we have the Roman Catholic documents, which are grouped in terms of teaching authority. And as I mentioned earlier, the highest authority is the Vatican, is an ecumenical council. So that document from that council comes first, and then selected papal addresses by Pope Paul VI, who presided over the latter part of the council after the great Pope John XXIII had died, who called the council, and then Pope John Paul II, the first Polish pope, great friend of the Jewish people, who on many, many occasions made dramatic and heartwarming statements about his appreciation and the whole church's appreciation of the Jewish heritage and the Jewish contribution to civilization and so on. Plus, then we deal with various groups like the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the German Conference of Bishops, the French Conference of Catholic Bishops, each of whom made striking statements out of their own situation. So that's Protestant, then Catholic. Then we have ecumenical Christian statements by bodies that include both Protestants and Catholics. Then a section on joint Christian-Jewish statements, in other words, ecumenical and then interfaith. Now, I would have liked to end this Volume 1 with Jewish statements. And in Volume 2, I do. But in the period of Volume 1, there were no Jewish statements. Now, I must say, I have to point out that these are statements at the national level that in the whole book, not a local level or a diocese of some sort, the national level. So instead of these Jewish statements, because Jewish persons and organizations were thoroughly involved in the Christian-Jewish dialogue, but it was not the habit of national Jewish organizations to issue statements of this nature. Well, they didn't have all this to apologize for and re-examine. So instead of that, I included two essays by two outstanding, maybe the two most outstanding Jewish thinkers or theologians of that period. Their key essays, from each of them, on the whole question of interreligious dialogue. One is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik from Orthodox Judaism, who tended to be against interfaith dialogue. But why? You read his essay, and he's very open in many ways. And then by Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, his famous essay, No Religion is an Island. He was not only an advocate of, but an ardent participant in interfaith dialogue.
So this is an example of two men from the same faith, they're both rabbis, disagreeing with the usefulness of having these dialogues.
That's right.
Interfaith dialogues.
Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, we can dialogue on matters of common concern, poverty in America, America's role in the world, or what have you, but not on theological matters. Those are too personal, too private, too idiosyncratic. We use our own language for these. But by and large, things have moved on beyond that to a very, very vigorous dialogue, including not a few Orthodox Jews as well.
And just to read a little passage from the book here by Dr. Franklin Sherman, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel of the conservative branch of Judaism wrote, "For him, applied religion was self-transcendence. Religion is more than doctrine. It is human beings seeking God. As we all share the same human nature, we all share the same yearning for the holy. No religious formulation is unsurpassable. God can always send new revelations. We must be open to hearing God's voice wherever and whenever God speaks. Jews and Christians will not agree on everything, but that is not the point of dialogue. The point is that we learn to appreciate the roles of both faith communities in the redemptive process."
Very good. I'm glad you selected that to read.
So different points of view are expressed in the book, and yet the point of the whole book is that there is dialogue.
Absolutely.
And that we can try to understand each other better.
That's right. The subtitle is The Road to Reconciliation. Now, in the second volume, the subtitle is Building a New Relationship, because once you get together, then you can work together to build, to enrich, to deepen that relationship with one another, and also, as even Rabbi Soloveitchik recommended, to work together at human problems in the world.
And that second volume is what you're currently working on, correct?
That's right.
And could you give us a quick sneak peek of what we could expect in that?
Well, there are two striking differences. One is that another branch of Christianity has been heard from, and that is Eastern Orthodox Christianity. By that is meant the ancient churches that predate the split between East and West in the days of the Roman Empire. It goes back that far. In other words, the Russian Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox, the Ukrainian Orthodox, and the Coptic Church in Egypt, and so on. They have now come into this dialogue, and there was a striking moment when the patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church from Athens, the patriarch of the whole Greek Orthodox Church around the world, made a visit to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington in 1997, and there he expressed his sense that anyone must have who visits that museum of being aghast at what had happened. But he had a prepared statement to be released of a rather similar nature to these other ones. But there it's a question, who was saying it? So that's one new thing. But the other thing, I mentioned that in the first volume, we didn't have formal Jewish statements, but rather the essays by the two theologians. But now there is there are some dozen or 14 or 15 statements in here by from Jewish sources. And one of the striking ones is a statement that was issued in the year 2000 by a group of Jewish scholars who were gathered together by a foursome of Jewish studies, scholars who first signed this, one from Notre Dame University, one from the University of Chicago, University of Toronto, University of Virginia. I could give the names. But in any case, who said to themselves and their fellow Jewish scholars and leaders, all these years Christians have been making these statements of self-examination, re-examining their own tradition. How have we fallen short in appreciating the other, especially Jews and Judaism? How about us Jews? Do we need to re-examine our view of Christians and Christianity? How adequately are we teaching about that in our curricula and in our preaching and so on? So they issued this statement called Dabru Emet. Now, that's a Hebrew term, capital D-A-B-R-U, capital E-M-E-T, meaning speak the truth. It's drawn from one of the prophets. Subtitle, A Jewish Statement on Christians and Christianity. Now, this is going to be in Volume 2. It was published as a full-page ad in the New York Times, so it got a lot of play at the time, but you'll be able to find it here. They said, in recent years, there has been a dramatic and unprecedented shift in Jewish and Christian relations. Throughout the nearly two millennia of Jewish exile, Christians have tended to characterize Judaism as a failed religion and so forth. But they want to make certain positive points, and they start out at the same point as one of those earlier statements did. They say, Jews and Christians worship the same God. Well, why should that have to be pinned down from the Jewish standpoint? Because you could say from the Jewish standpoint, what is this about the divinity of Christ, the Holy Trinity, that one God or three gods? Something has gone off the track there from the Jewish standpoint. But they say, nevertheless, fundamentally Christians are worshiping, as we do, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and David, and so on. And they refer to the common sources in the Bible, what we call the Old Testament. And then they go into something we were into earlier in discussing Nazism, the National Socialist period, and they say Nazism was not a Christian phenomenon. Well, you might say, why have to put that in such a statement? Whoever said it was. But I think we dealt with this earlier. One of our callers asked that. Did the Nazis use theological categories? And they didn't, but they built upon years of anti-Jewish stereotyping from the standpoint of the churches. Nevertheless, it was not a Christian phenomenon. It was a pagan religion, if it was, and in a certain sense, it was a religion. And so they go through all of this, and they reassure Jews that coming into dialogue and common relations with Christians will not weaken your Jewish faith. It'll probably strengthen it.
So we have something to look forward to in Volume 2 of this series of Bridges. Will it also be called Bridges?
Yes, it will.
But the subtitle will be?
Building a New Relationship.
Right. And so we're getting the Eastern Orthodox Christianity into it and the Jewish perspective into it as well. Dr. Franklin Sherman, our time is up. We appreciate your coming over to our studios and enlightening us about the dialogue among Christians and among Jews.
And we look forward to Volume 2 of Bridges.
Very good.
That's it for Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thanks for listening, and remember to be gentle with your neighbor.